Hello, everybody, boys and girls, ladies and gentlemen, lords and ladies.
Very nice.
Lords and
Yes.
ladies, oh yes.
Yes. Dukes and duchesses. Yes.
Oh. Dukes
Yeah.
and duchesses, and those in the not in the cheap seats can rattle your jewellery, as John Lennon put it once. That was performing for the Queen, and anyway, which I've not had to do yet, and probably won't now. Unless she comes back to life again and reincarnation's all true. But anyway, I'm John Atack, and this is my dear friend and colleague, Hoyt Richards. Hello, Hoyt.
Hello, John. Nice to see you as always.
As always.
Yes.
So go ahead, introduce the topic, and we'll see if
Yeah,
we can kick it
we were
around.
just talking about this a little bit before we got online here, and I thought truth bias is a great description, topic, because a lot of people I don't think are even aware of it, even though clearly it's something that we have that's kind of inherent. Kind of, it seems to be kind of a primal directive or primal hardwiring to our psyches that we just as a species, when hearing what someone else is telling us, we just instinctively want to take them at their word. And the idea that this person or any person could possibly be deceiving or manipulating or misleading us with whatever impression we're getting is something that doesn't readily cross our minds. I mean, it's one of these things. I try to go through my life having had the experience I've had with some healthy skepticism, but I also really love the fact that that I have a trusting nature, because I do want to kind of think of the best of people and give them the benefit of the doubt and kind of hope that that is a larger component of the world than those who don't. But I think until you look into truth bias and become aware that this is something that's kind of innate in all of us, it's something that's very easily exploited and we can be manipulated. And so I think it's a fun topic to talk about. I'm kind of curious for you, like what's been your experience of truth bias, and how would you define it, and how would you say it's impacted your life, before and after, like before you knew it existed, before you knew it was a thing, and then after you knew it was a thing, so to speak.
Well, I think you're right that I don't know if it's innate. But certainly through our culture, we as kids are taught to trust people. And a part of that is obedience, the obedience training of school, which my friend Ira Chalef has in his Intelligent Disobedience has pointed towards. And so
It's a great
we
problem. Yeah.
how much is nature, how much is nurture, I don't know, but we want to belong, we're sociable. And I realized when I left Scientology in 1983 that part of the reason I was there and many others were there was because of this trust factor, that we'd been brought up to trust people. I realized that Scientology, for the most part, you could say was a middle class group, because people who'd come from a working background were less trusting. They weren't brought up to trust in the same way. And it gave them, sometimes because of aggression in their childhood, but it
Right.
gave them a more skepticism. And so they would, I can remember talking with people who'd like, well, why do you believe that? What's that about? But the whole, being educated and being sophisticated, and there is so much trust involved. And you have this situation where, if you're smart, then you realize that the world is being run by many, many corrupt people. That corporations and governments are infested with these people. And it only takes a very small proportion of them to make life extraordinarily difficult for us. So, I mean, I've recently, I've just, I think, recorded my fourth show with Sean McCraney, who is a sociopath who has sought to reform himself. And getting inside his mind and saying, I don't trust anybody. I don't have any empathy. And
Right.
realizing that it only takes a small amount of those people to sell us a piece of blue sky or whatever. And away we go. So, and that trust in authority, you know, that
right.
You know, we grew up being told that there are people who know things. You know, they are, you know, priests in the church, or they are politicians, or what have you. And you start finding out that as soon as you've got corruption in a high place, then there will be trouble for all concerned. So it is difficult. I would like to think the best of everyone, but I know that's foolish. I think it's better to have a more neutral position. And when something sounds wrong, to question it. And whether you question it with the person who's spouting it, or whether you go away and check it. I've got to go here. I don't want to get complicated. Stop me if I get complicated.
Okay.
Sean McCraney recommended a book to me called A First Rate Madness by a professor of psychiatry at Tufts in Boston, an Ivy League university, called Nasir Gaymi. He's also, he runs a mood disorders clinic, and he's on the faculty at Harvard Medical School. Now, one of the things I teach people is, you know, why should you trust something? You know, be a bit more skeptical. And so the first thing is, what's the qualification of the person to give you the information? He's a professor of psychiatry at an Ivy League university. He's got a degree in history. And his argument is that in times of crisis, mad people make the best leaders.
Mad people make the best leaders.
Yeah, and he doesn't properly differentiate in the book between mental illness, such as depression, and madness, such as the full-on bipolar manic depression.
So he doesn't even fully define what madness would be.
And he's a psychiatrist, and you're going, well, surely you understand that madness is a state where there is delusion, hallucination, paranoia, this kind of thing. Whereas a mental illness, such as depression, which is his major form, doesn't mean that there's anything delusive. It means that things are colored a certain way, that, you know, they're made gray by the condition. So as his first example of a great leader in a time of crisis, he gives William Tecumseh Sherman. The man who marched through Georgia, burned Savannah and Atlanta.
Burned everything in his path.
Yeah. And invented what's now called total war, where you destroy everything. And this is a great leader. And he doesn't mention anything about Sherman's career after the war, where he was at the Bureau of Indian Affairs and, of course, ran the genocide of the Plains people. So I'm already going, when you say great.
Yeah, exactly. So not only are you not defining what's mad, but you're also not defining what's great. Mm. Neither seem to be very consistent.
And it's a New York Times bestseller, and it's got all sorts of rave reviews about what a great book it is. And I'm going, is anybody who actually studied history reading this? So one of the points he makes, which is the point that I first picked up on, Sean was like, well, how did you know straight away that there was something wrong here? He said, well, you told me that he says that Neville Chamberlain didn't resist Hitler. And I know this myth. I know it well. I've read a great deal about it. Mm. And he talks about Chamberlain's infamous inability to recognize the dangers of Hitler. And you're going, infamous inability. So I went and looked it up, and I read a book about Chamberlain a few years ago. Right. And in there, you have a 1935 diary entry from Chamberlain's diary saying, you know, we've got a pacifist nation. We've got to do something to rearm. And of course, ordered rearmament as Chancellor of the Exchequer, Secretary of the Treasury. He ordered it. And where the whole of the Labour benches voted against rearmament, he led rearmament. It was him that decided we had to have fighter aircraft. And Churchill, who was out of government from 1931 onwards because he didn't like the idea of home rule for India, he wanted to keep the empire whole. That was what Winnie was up to. So he'd walked out of government and had no real voice. And they've got this myth about him being the only member of parliament who's complaining about Hitler. And you're going, this is a fabrication. And this guy writing this book has a degree in history. So,
it is. It's fascinating because it makes me even think about what you know they're claiming. And I think it seems pretty accurate. Is a lot of the issues with the AIs that are out there right now, because when you consider the way like the like these chat GPTs and these big what they call language model AI,
Large language models, yeah.
large language, right? So what they're doing, they're asking the, which is a huge ask, they're asking this machine to swallow the volume of information on the internet, which is a massive ask, right? But the biggest problem with that is the majority, the vast majority, I think it's as high, and I don't think this is inaccurate, I think it's upwards of 99% of the data that is on the internet is biased or inaccurate. You know, and so you're asking this machine to swallow all of that and use that as its foundational basis to answer questions with you. You know, and it's got a compulsion to give you some answer, even if it doesn't know for sure. So it will fabricate an answer just to, so that it can answer. And you know, and because its resource is, you know, vast majority of dirty data, you're getting information that's more than likely not accurate, that people are taking at its word rather than doing the research to check it. You know,
Exactly.
so and that's only going to get worse, because the more the machine keeps creating these answers, the more it keeps flooding the market with more dirty data, and it's and it will eventually, they say, will start to behave like dementia, you know, where it won't be able to tell the truth, but you know,
Well,
between what's truth or truth, accurate or inaccurate, so to speak.
absolutely. And I mean, when ChatGPT went up, I sort of thought, well, okay, I'll check it on something that I know. And it
Right.
happened last April. I'm still working on Charlie Manson and his incredible involvement with Scientology, profound involvement with Scientology, which nobody has commented on.
Amazing.
And so I sort of went, all right, what church did Charles Manson's grandmother belong to? I asked that question. And it came back with the wrong answer.
Wow.
It was the Church of the Nazarene that she actually belonged to. And it's not a hidden piece of information. And with the Manson material, it makes it very obvious. I've, read 16 books and been through all sorts of material. There is so much that's not true. There is so much that is repeated and carried on from one book to the next. And you can trace it from the point where an author got it wrong through to the absurdity of, say, Tom O'Neill's Chaos, which was
Right.
what got me started, where he's attacking, my late friend Jolly West, who I did not know well. We met four times. We spent a few hours together each time, but he was thoroughly helpful. I've never met anybody who had more information than Jolly and had got it
Yeah.
sorted out. He was an expert on all sorts of things, and he was a good man. He marched with Martin Luther King. He campaigned against the death penalty. And from 1951 to his death, he campaigned against Scientology. Now, allegations are then made about him being a sociopath. And you're going, well, here's a simple equation. Sociopaths do not put themselves in the line of fire. They won't do stuff that puts them,
Right,
so he's not going to be marching with Martin Luther King. That's a very dangerous thing to do. And
exactly.
to have stood up at an American Psychiatric Association annual meeting and said, I will continue to criticize Scientology as a cult no matter how many times they sue me. And I think they sued him more than a dozen times. So to characterize him in this way, and then O'Neill tells us he spent 20 years researching this book, 20 years researching this book. Now, I've done a little bit of research in my time.
Yeah.
20 years, that's deep. And he's in the end, he says in the book that the best he can prove is that Jolly West walked the same corridors, and I quote exactly, of the Haight-Ashbury Free Clinic in San Francisco that Charles Manson had walked. That he doesn't ever have them meeting, he doesn't have a single document, and he's putting forward the idea in an article. He actually said that Jolly West wrote the blueprint for MK Ultra, for the 146 despicable operations of the CIA. And again, there's no evidence. And we find the Times Literary Supplement calling this book a masterpiece. And I look at it and go, where are we living now? How do we estimate truth? And as you say, there's another problem, of course, with artificial intelligence, as Microsoft admitted, that it hallucinates. So you've not only got that it can't differentiate between truth and falsehood, but it'll make stuff up. So the dementia is already built in to the system. Hopefully they will improve. But until you can verify information and learn how to do that, and watching all of, you know, Google and people sort of talking about how to verify information, none of them have come up with a, you know, it's something I too have been working on for years.
Right.
How do you do this? And Nasir Gamey has given me this wonderful book where the first stages of it, you know, will, is your source trustworthy? Absolutely. Degree in history, professor of psychiatry, Harvard Med School, you know, absolutely he's trustworthy, but he's wrong. Mm. And how do you teach people that next level of sitting back from information and not trusting it, but not being aggressive towards it? You know, sitting back and going, well, I'll verify that. You know, what did Neville Chamberlain think? Oh, he campaigned, you know, in the final part of the story, the appeasement of Munich in September 1938, when he should have declared war, according to a man called Michael Foot, who would later become leader of the Labour Party, and who was the co-author of a book in 1940 called The Guilty Men, accusing Chamberlain of, you know, not having fought against Hitler. And you're going, but your Labour MPs all voted to put the money into schools and hospitals and none of it towards. By the time they got to Munich, Chamberlain went out there, the consummate politician, knowing that the Czech defences were useless because Austria had now joined the Anschluss, the union with Germany. And while Czechoslovakia had wonderful defences along the German border, it had none along the Austrian border. He knew there were 3 million German speakers in the Sudetenland who were being persecuted by the Czechs, something that doesn't get into our history books. There was a massacre of 80 Germans on one day, German speakers. And so Hitler was, in fact, trying to protect these people, which goes against everything we'd like to think about Hitler. Chamberlain knew they couldn't be defended. And, you know, that Czechoslovakia couldn't be defended. That was the military report. We've now got the chiefs of staff's report about Czechoslovakia. There was nothing that could be done to help it. But he also knew that he only had 12 high-altitude fighter aeroplanes, Hawker Hurricanes, 12. So if, as these people now are saying, oh, you see, he should have gone to war, it would have been over by Christmas, and I'd be speaking German now.
That's right. Right.
So, but you need a lot more information to be able to understand something. And here is the problem, I think, that we become passionately committed to these ideas. Winston Churchill was a great bloke. I won't have anything said against Winston Churchill. I know he was only 5'6", but not as tall as Hitler, but he was a wonderful man. And you're going, no, he's one of the most complicated people in history. He was brilliant. I mean, you know, when he sat at a dinner party and the woman next to him says, if you were my husband, I'd put poison in your coffee. And Churchill looks and says, if I were your husband, I'd drink it. You know, so his incredible wit. He wrote beautiful English, but he also, it said, kept photos of the Dresden bombing on his office wall, where somewhere over 100,000 people, I think, were killed in firebombing of a civilian population. But I won't hear anything said against Winston Churchill. He was a wonderful man.
Well, yeah, I mean, that brings up another aspect of the whole thing with truth bias is confirmation bias, right? That's where we only want to take in information that supports whatever our beliefs are.
Confirmation, it's also sometimes called my side bias, which I think is a very direct way of saying
Exactly. My side bias, where you'll kind of self-center, I think the way it's been described, it's not always conscious. It's something that we just unconsciously filter out and only take in the information that reinforces the belief we want to hold on to. So I mean, when I think about it like that, is it really, and we've talked about, you know, the ego stuff in the past, like, you know, one of the great kind of equalizers for people coming to even understand like their cultic experience or anything major, you know, falling out of the category, maybe a mistake they made in life, is having the humility to admit they had the mistake, or that you got conned, or that you got manipulated. You know, I mean, I've experienced that not only in my own life, but also trying to speak to ex-members of my group. Mm-hmm. There's just resistance to accepting the clear-cut facts because it goes against their self-image of thinking that they could have been kind of conned or taken on such a major scale.
I'm
And
too
so
smart for that.
that's right, exactly. So there'll be 98% of information out there that shows deception and lying occurred, and they'll cling on to that 2% because it allows their ego to stay in check and feel empowered. And that's, I think, a huge part of this is, I mean, I don't know. I'm asking, like, do you think it is the ego issue? Is that what kind of it is that stops us from being more skeptical, that challenges our, and it obviously requires more effort, like to actually research something and to investigate all is it a factor of us being a little more lazy, would you think? Or I mean how, what do you think plays into the fact that we just, the majority of us, don't really investigate or are readily able to admit that we just got taken,
I
in
don't
this.
think that it's natural. I don't think we're born with, brilliant perception and interpretation, and all we have to do is, put the on switch on and we'll understand the world. I don't think we're taught how to do it. In fact, I know we aren't taught how to do it. We aren't taught really anything about how to reason, beyond being taught perhaps the scientific method, which, is a part of finding out how to, observation and experiment and hypothesis, theory, law, that kind of stuff. All great. Do some experiments, get them replicated by somebody else. That's very sensible, but it's not enough. So we're not born with these skills. We're not taught these skills. We may acquire them. And I mean, that's what you and I have spent so many years trying to do to understand. What is the conundrum, and how do you solve it? There are certain fundamental ideas. One of them is William James' idea of the feelings of knowing, the feelings of certainty.
Oh, right, exactly.
What I've just said about Jolly West, we will inevitably get a couple of people commenting on this saying, Jolly West worked for the CIA. I know it. And every time somebody says that, I say, how do you know it? Do you know it because it feels true? Or do you know it because if you have evidence, share it with me. And I very frequently challenge people to, well, just tell me what it is you actually know. And usually it feels that it must be so, that, and understanding that in ourselves, I mean, I did a video about 4 years ago called something like, Am I Certain About That? Or, And we've talked about it before, that
Absolutely.
so how do we sort that out? And I think there's something that maybe is even more fundamental in the sense of ego, which is a kind of a difficult term in and of itself, and there's different schools have different views of what it means. It means self in its origins. It's a word for I, ego. A few years ago, I this thing that got me as soon as I left Scientology, it was like, well, I'm showing these people that he's a liar. He says this thing here and he contradicts it here. And they're saying, yeah, well, he had two bodies, or there's some, incredible reason for why this is true. And I couldn't understand. It's like, look, this is in front of your face. It's a hand. See? And they're going, no, that's not a hand. And I'm kind of, how do you get the obvious over to people? How do you get people to look at what's in front of their eyes? And a few years ago, having labored with this problem for decades, I went, oh, there's something I hadn't noticed. If I accept when you say that my perception and interpretation of the world is not correct, if I accept that, where does that put me in terms of everything I know? And it challenges, and then you get cognitive dissonance. The whole world starts wobbling if, and it's something that's very evident, say, with racism and with the gender problems that people have that you get funny about. That when you challenge somebody, there was In Ken Burns Jazz, there's a white jazz critic, quite an old guy in his 70s, even older than me. And he says, you know, I was brought up in the South and we were taught that black people were an inferior species. That's what we were taught. And then one night as a teenager, I went into a club and there was this man called Louis Armstrong playing there. And it was the first time I'd ever seen a genius.
Right.
And I, all of my, how can this be true? I've, my whole life, I've been brought up to feel that these people are sort of somewhere between the apes and white people. And the only person I've ever seen who was an undeniable, undoubtable genius and probably the most influential musician of the 20th century was this very black man, this wonderful man, Louis Armstrong. And so the cognitive dissonance can fracture. You can see that, but then finding out how these prejudices are maintained and how anything that's strange to us, anything that's unfamiliar, you know, we get xenophobia. We don't like things that are foreign, that are odd, that are different. And learning to embrace those things and bring, you know, cross our cultures over, mix things together so that we can create something new is fundamentally how the arts have moved through the centuries, by accepting the other, the stranger, the new idea, rather than the, you know, we keep on doing it the same way, year in, year out.
I mean, it's really like, you know, it makes things more complicated, right? And more challenging and more difficult. And I think there's a resistance to that because I think, you know, it's one of the, I certainly look at my, you know, indoctrination into my cultic thinking, you know, that I was falling prey to shortcuts, which I would describe as them making bold statements that I just had to accept as truth with very little investigation, right?
And they were the authorities, they knew.
Right, exactly. And I liked the way it sounded. And it certainly, in some way, simplified my life. I say, oh, well, this is just the way it works. It's like, it's as if someone says, well, here's the rule book, here's the do's and the don'ts, just do the do's and don't do the don'ts and you'll be okay. I'm like, oh, awesome. And so you don't recognize at the time that it's really a form of manipulation. You think someone's trying to help you out and someone, you know, give, and quite often it's also added to the thing of saying, well, because you're special or because you're unique or because I recognize the potential in you, I'm going to give you the manual on how it all figured out. I did all this work for everyone, so I've figured it out. And here I'm going to pass it on to you because you're special. And, you know, that feeling of thinking, you know, because I'm being kind of chosen on some level, that I don't have to suffer through what the normal tribulations and complications of trying to figure it out for myself. Mm-hmm. But clearly life is about us figuring it out for ourselves. And there's such a pull into whether you want to call it like peer pressure or groupthink or this thing of like, you know, it's just so much easier to go along with what everyone else is doing and not resist the kind of the mainstream way, so to speak. And I think it's just something that if you don't pull back and at least try to get that 10,000, you know, foot view of our life or our world, you just don't see how just going along with the flow can be really detrimental to not only ourselves, but just the way we even perceive what we're seeing. It just colors everything. But I know for me, it's like just knowing that was a tendency in most people, myself included, and, you know, was helpful to at least say, oh, I can't just take everyone at their word anymore, you know, even though I want to, and even though I'd like to, I need to somehow develop a mechanism where I just keep some idea that, you know, of skepticism that maybe this isn't accurately being portrayed, that there's a chance that, you know, something could be happening here that I should be aware of and I should always take the time to reevaluate, maybe do some research, and consider the fact that what I've experienced or what I've been told might not be as, you know, taken on face value as I think so.
Yeah, and I mean, in a culture that's very individualistic, that we're a very selfish culture, the Western culture, you know, where Asian cultures and African cultures are, and Aboriginal cultures are more inclined towards the family, through to the sense, you know, when you look at Japanese culture, that if you have disgraced the family, you have to kill yourself, and that gives the family back its honor. So, but there is this idea that you're part of this continuum, the family. Whereas in the West, it's, you know, grabbing as much for yourself as you possibly can. I have a close friend who's Jewish, and he was very surprised that he said, you know, in my culture, if somebody makes some money, they spread it through the family. It's immediate. It's part of our culture going back. Whereas in the Western culture, you have this thing of, well, it's mine, you know, and I'm Bill Gates or Warren Buffett or what have you, and I've got this huge pile of stuff. It belongs to me. And it, you know, but I think in that individualistic culture, one of the things that doesn't happen is us becoming individuals. You know, that we belong to the mass, and we do the things like having the nice car and the lovely house and the trophy wife and that kind of stuff that belong to the culture, but we don't actually separate ourselves out and say, oh, I'm an individual. I am, you know, Monty Python in Life of Brian, you know, we're all different. I'm not.
You're all different.
Yes, we are all different.
I'm not.
you know, this phrase neurodivergent, this expression that's come into the language, and I'm kind of going, show me somebody who isn't, you know, show me who's somebody whose brain is normal. Yeah. We're all, to some extent, neurodivergent, whether it be, you know, my lovely wife, she has colors for the days of the week. Every day of the week has a color for her. And she said this a few days ago, she was off with her sister. And she said to her sister, and they've known each other a long time, she said to her sister, do you have colors for the days of the week? And to her amazement, her sister said, oh yeah, Monday's black and Tuesday's this. And I kind of look at that and go, I'm sorry, that makes absolutely no sense whatsoever to me, because that's not how I see the world. So realizing that we are different, that we are individual, and rejoicing in that, being able to say, yeah, you know, I like truffles, or you know, I like, you know, 85% chocolate, or I like chips, or I like lobster, or you know, I like whatever it is you like, that you don't have to be part of the mass. And what will make you special and wonderful is how you differ from others. And so developing your own interpretation, understanding the limitations of our perception, but being able to sit back quietly. My mum had this thing that people thought she was very saintly, and she wasn't. She just learned how to bite her tongue. And if she realized somebody was going to disagree with her, she wouldn't bother talking with them. It's like, what's the point? You know, I know you're wrong, and I'm not going to argue with you.
Yeah.
But having that quietness in yourself where somebody says something that's ludicrous, and rather than going, oh yeah, well, he probably did see a hedgehog flying, you know, probably the only time it's happened, but he probably did. Sort of going, well, just as with AI, we pick up wrong information, you know, as Nasir Gamey did about a degree in history about Churchill and about Sherman. And he then goes on about, you know, JFK being crazy and that he was better at the end of his presidency because he was taking less drugs, you know, less steroids and less. I mean, he tells us that Nixon was healthy and normal. And you're going, so bombing Cambodia is a healthy and normal thing for. And he doesn't know that Nixon was daily taking a drug called Dilantin. I know about that, you know, but, you know, which has psychotropic effects. He puts forward the point of view, and my favorite thing, I think, in the book, that Adolf Hitler was not an antisocial personality. And you're going, well, causing the deaths of 50 million people, if that's not antisocial, I don't know what is. You know, how are we defining these ideas? You know, and so understanding that we can have wrong information, and that anybody else can have wrong information, and rather than trying to defeat them, we might be able to persuade them to think about these things. It's where Socrates was quite good. This idea of, yeah, well, if you think this, what about this? Not being hostile, not being aggressive, but getting somebody to think about these thoughts, and then every now and then going down to the evidence and saying, 12 high altitude fighter planes, you want to fight with the German Luftwaffe now?
Well, you know, what's interesting is when I was doing a little research on something else, and I came across this, there was a study, apparently it's like an Oxford guy named Pentazi and Klein and Kissing. And they basically said, they led a study, I'll read it, they led a study of a group of participants acting as jurors, in quotes. Mm. They presented the participants with information pertaining to two criminal defendants and with the information on the sentences that the defendants were given before asking them to come up with the appropriate prison term and determine how dangerous each defendant was. Mm. Participants were also told that some of the information that had been given was not true, and were told exactly which pieces of information weren't true. The question studied wanted to answer is whether participants would appropriately discount the false information, or would it influence their decisions?
And of course it did.
Yeah, ultimately the study found that people who received negative information about the defendant were influenced by it, even when they were explicitly told it was not true. And even more strikingly, the study was able to quantify the impact of memory, identifying that participants tended to misremember false evidence as being true.
Yeah.
So there you're being told, right, that this is not true. And yet there's a resistance to accepting that. So I think that's a fascinating thing to also apply. And I guess that probably comes, you know, that's where the confirmation bias aspect of it comes, you know, or, you know, like I said, then you mentioned earlier, just the fact that it complicates something, there's a resistance to deal with the more complex. So you keep trying to distill it into something more simple and just say, well, I'm just going to go with my gut. Or like you said, the feeling I have. Mm-hmm. And just how dangerous that is for ourselves, you know, and how we're, and to each other, if we can't really even take, you know, someone telling us something, oh, just that thing I just told you, oh, that's inaccurate. Well, no, I kind of like what you just told me. No, but I actually found out that's not true. Oh, no, but I kind of like the sound. I mean, I think that's a fascinating part to consider, like even in the face of being told that we have this kind of faulty mechanism, you know, that, you know, either by the way we were brought up or just by what we inherited as our, you know, primary wiring, that even that doesn't stop us from kind of being, you know, falling into that pattern. I mean, I just think it's, I know for me, it's really helpful. Like I look at, you know, having been through this cultic experience and learned a lot about manipulation and narcissism and all these sort of things. And you think like, oh, okay, well, you know, now I know these things exist. I have firsthand experience. I've had these, you know, episodes of my life that have taught me that certain information's, you know, by using my own direct experience, you know, it's a great asset as a resource to say, oh, I had that experience. I find that to be, you know, something that you know seems to be truthful, you know, because I think you can't. I think it's always challenging to not just accept something as a bold face, this is an absolute. You know, we've talked about this before. I think the shades of gray, the falling into the absolutes is part of the trap, right? So I try to stay in that shades of gray, but say, oh, this, there seems to be a tendency here. My life has shown that be aware of this. And yet I can still fall prey to those narcissistic personalities because they are very tricky and savvy and sometimes, you know, just don't present themselves as that. And if I, you know, experience that feeling of, oh, this person seems like they're really looking out for me, or that I just fall into the trap again. And so it really seems to be this constant work in progress that I have to check myself and be vigilant. Like, just because I have a trusting nature doesn't mean I'm going to, be smart to trust everyone every time, and that's really difficult. I think it's like Scott Peck said in The Road Less Traveled, the first three lines, life is difficult. Like, it's hard to sometimes accept that it is complicated, it is complex, and we don't really get to a point where we get to coast. It just seems to be a challenge. Mm. You have to be vigilant. What do you think?
I think that's true. And a lot of what is sold in pseudo religions, cult groups, is this idea that you'll achieve a state of bliss, you'll achieve a state of equanimity, you'll be able to deal with everything. And the reality is that the river will keep moving and you've got to swim, because otherwise you'll drown. And I mean, so much that one of the problems with the jurors is the first impression rule. And we do need to be wary of this, that we tend to believe the first thing we're told about something.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's very hard to dislodge that. And learning to do that, learning to enjoy the cognitive dissonance, to say, oh, this is interesting. And that it's, things are giving us a bad feeling. It gives us a bad feeling to disagree with our tribe, with our family, with our group. And so you get loyalties that become horrifically dangerous. We've talked about genocidal murder and the gathering together of people who did it years later going, oh, those are the great days, wonderful things. You also have something that I call the unquestionable assumption. And I went out and started my exit counseling career back in 1991. And had the most horrific experience. We were followed by seven carloads of Scientologists who never, we had 4 days with this young man.
Wow.
And they didn't find him, but they found us. And so we had to escape them every day. It was like, being in a John le Carré novel pursued by the Marx Brothers because of the incredible incompetence of Scientology's Office of Special Affairs. But we got away with it. But I came back from that for the first time in my life, having had five consecutive nights where I got only 3 hours sleep, something that's quite normal sadly, for members of Scientology's Sea Organization, but was not something I'd ever experienced. And I was all over the place from this awful experience. And I found myself going, this thing just bubbled up. It was like, I believe that I should love everybody. I was taught as an infant that I should love everybody, that, Jesus and you've got to love everybody and all of this. And I had 3 days of wrestling with that one thought and going, of course you do. Of course you do. You have to love everybody. That's the law. That's the way it is. And at the end of 3 days, I finally went, no, I have the right to choose. I will choose not to hurt anybody. That's the best I can offer. Nobody is actually deserving of my sacrifice, of my love. So that's, and that differentiation. And I realized that what I just dealt with was an unquestionable assumption. And we run on these things, these ideas that,
Exactly. And I think, our only real defense is just to be aware of these tendencies and be aware. Because if you're not exposed to them in what I can only describe as a kind of a clinical or scientific perspective, there's just a kind of, whether it's a resistance or an obliviousness to accepting that that could possibly be something that is occurring in our lives. I just think, it's one of the things that, and just like that study is saying, that even when you're told that this evidence is incorrect, there's still a resistance. Like if you're not given that type of information and examples of this is what we do as being someone in a body, I think it's just hard to believe. And because it feels so like I look at like the way a typical thing cultic type groups will talk about is unconditional love. And that sounds fantastic, right? Oh, I'm going to get to a place where I just, like you just said, I'm going to love everybody. You know? And I think that it's such a powerful, again, another absolute, that we lean into that thinking, oh, wouldn't that be marvelous? And then, you know, and even the group that's presenting this to us is bereft with contradictions of that all the time. It's just like you said, saw in Scientology, and I saw in my group, once someone either left or got kicked out or whatever, man, you got demonized. And not our group, not unlike the way Scientology operates. It's not that you just maybe shunned them or, you know, said that you went after them and tried to make their life worse, you know? So where's the unconditional love in that, you know? And so I just think it's these things that I encourage people to, you know, look into this type of information, because our only defense is to be aware that it happens. And it just, I think you bring up a great point of, unless you were kind of brought up in a way that I would only call like really taught you street smarts, like if you had to grow up in under great challenges of just not knowing where your next meal would come from or whether you're going to survive the next day, then I think you develop probably really healthy skepticism that the world isn't a beautiful, kind, you know, friendly place all the time, and you have to be on your guard and be aware, and people could betray or hurt you or try to kill you, whatever it may be. I think, yeah, then that type of individual having that kind of upbringing would probably have a very healthy skeptical point of view. But for most of us who went up, you know, through a, you know, education system, you know, a fairly healthy, you know, although I'm sure a little bit dysfunctional family, you know, element, you're just taught to believe that you can't take people at their word, and people aren't trying to deceive you and manipulate you. And that is, you know, I think a really, you know, great way to want the world to be. But then you have to face the reality that the world really isn't like that, you know, in full colors. And I think, you know, if you don't get yourself that information, you're really kind of putting yourself at a disadvantage unconsciously, you know, and so it's something that I think I don't know. I mean, I know your friend's book, Civil Disobedience, is a great book. I mean, is there other sources that you would say that
Intelligent Disobedience, Civil Disobedience, is a good idea too? Yeah, Ira Chaloff. His Courageous Followership is also a brilliant idea. And let me say that if people had a difficult childhood, then it often, in fact, leads them to unhealthy skepticism. It leads them to cynicism, right, where they don't trust anybody. And finding that ground where you're not distrusting of everyone and you're not trusting of everyone. So looking at the signs that they're giving you, and when somebody lets you down, forgiving them but not forgetting. You know, right, remembering that. You know, I had a friend who, a friend of mine was approached by another friend who said, would he lend him some money for a short-term loan while he was buying a flat, an apartment? And the friend who was being asked for the money came to me and said, well, should I let him have the money? And I said, absolutely not. He won't repay you. He's a lovely guy.
Nice. He's
a dear, sweet, wonderful guy. But I know he won't repay you. You know, it's just the way it is. He'll find something else and need the money for something else. And that's what happened. And they'd been very close friends. And it was awful to see that this, you know, how were they going to go on from here? Because it was a sizable amount of money.
Right.
And that got me to the point, I'm still in Scientology then, that got me to the point where I realized you trust people according to your knowledge of them. But, you know, there are friends that you will not leave your girlfriend with. You know?
Yeah.
That, you know, there are people you wouldn't lend money to. There are all sorts of things, but you can trust them in other ways, and you learn how you can do that. But we need to be aware. We need to grow up. We need to develop ourselves and mature to the point where when somebody is telling us a bullshit story, we can go, oh, that sounds like bullshit, and go away and check, find out. Of course, you know, one of the consummate aspects of a bullshitter is that they will continue, oh, how dare you not believe me?
Right, exactly. You know, and I also think it's that thing of like when people reveal themselves, pay attention. Like even yeah. though we liked the self-image we had of someone that we considered that we're close to, or we put in maybe an authoritarian position, and that's been a comfortable relationship because we found that more, you know, fairly consistently they were kind of a voice of reason, maybe of some sort. But if they reveal another side, that you know, it doesn't necessarily disqualify what was there before. It's not either or, it's both and, you know. Yes. I think that's the challenge, is as people, as we go through life and people reveal themselves, pay attention and add it to the mix. Don't feel you have to kind of throw the baby out with the bathwater every time, but pay attention. And I say this as something I struggle with as well. Like, it's not easy to do, but I, you know, I find myself saying that to people more often than not because of what I've learned. Like, yeah, when people reveal themselves, definitely make note and pay attention. You know?
Yes, absolutely. And keep all of the information there. What is good about this person, and what, you know, they may be able to transform. As I say, with the conversations I've had with Sean McCraney, it is wonderful to talk with somebody who's saying, I realized I was a sociopath, and I realized that was no life, you know, that it isolates you. It isn't a good way to be, to feel contempt towards everybody. He's, you know, he's a highly intelligent man. He was a stock trader. And he's somebody who twice a week would go out to get into bar fights to hurt people because he liked that. And, you know, sex and drugs and rock and roll were a major part of his lifestyle. And then one day he realized this was an awful way to be. And he's, you know, that was 1997. But he is somebody who shows you that there are people out there, a small percentage, we're told about 2% of people are psychopaths, sociopaths, whatever word we want to use for that, antisocial personalities. Mm. Unlike Hitler, of course, who wasn't. He's very social, a lovely man, much misunderstood, and a fabulous dancer. Sorry, great painter, a whole apartment, two coats, one afternoon. We've gone off into Mel Brooks territory here suddenly, or I have. That only a tiny amount of people are this way inclined, but they can influence everybody else. Mm. And, you know, when we give them power, you know, looking at our crop of politicians at the moment, I am not very impressed. I can't see anybody I'd particularly want to vote for. What a terrible situation that is.
It really is. I mean, I don't follow enough of world politics, but I don't even know if there's any politician I've ever heard anyone recently. And I mean, and I'm talking, you know, going back at probably even a couple decades, that really feel like, oh, that person really was a stand-up person.
Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, maybe. You
know, I don't know enough about him, but he's the only person who's been.
Either. Yeah, I know. Yeah. I know some people that have spoken strongly, but yeah, it feels like that. That yeah, there's just no one you'd want to vote for, you know. And I think that's a pretty sad analysis of where we are right now. And
and maybe this is a point of pendulum swing. Maybe this is a point where, because I do think that for the most part, you know, the overall conscience of humanity has greatly improved in the last 200 years. You know, don't send four-year-old kids up chimneys, no matter how annoying they are. We don't send them down mines. We think child labor's a bad idea. In the last two decades, we've started to face the problem of child abuse and do something about it in some of our institutions. So these are important changes. And I think having that understanding of, you know, what a better society would look like, but looking at the inertia of politicians over pollution, you know, let alone climate change. Let's just look at pollution as an issue, that we're still pumping sewage into our waterways. We're still pumping toxic chemicals, you know. And, you know, after the banking crash in 2008, what was done to make sure it wouldn't happen again? Nothing. Oh, we just gave them a load of money.
Yeah, the bad actors just got, you know, Christmas bonuses. You know, that's what they got.
Yeah. So, but I think we are, I think there is enough public indignation so that if, and we saw in France that with Emmanuel Macron, who's not somebody I admire, but we saw that within a year, it was possible to put together a political party and have a president and I think 80% of the assembly just throwing out the old parties and the old way of doing it. In the US, it's a bit more difficult, though.
Yeah.
The web may make promotion rather easier, as the Trump found in his two campaigns. But, you know, you need $1 billion to stand for president. Well, that's wrong. That's not democracy. That's plutocracy. And the control, the corruption of the political parties, which is endemic and perpetual. When you look at American politics, Tammany Hall and all of the things that have gone on in the past. And, you know, how many of the presidents would you actually trust? You know, but apparently Richard Nixon, of course, was healthy and normal. And so we should have trusted him, probably.
Yeah, no, I think it really is a point you made earlier, which really resonated with me, is we just have to become more comfortable with the cognitive dissonance that comes with accepting that things are just infinitely more complex and complicated than we want to see them at first glance. I just think, you know, we just have to find it within ourselves to recognize that that, you know, this that we have a tendency to take things at face value, which serve, you know, to support whatever beliefs we have that makes our life less complicated. Mm-hmm. But the truth is that life is complicated and it's supposed to be complicated to challenge us to become better versions of ourselves. Mm-hmm. So embrace the battle, so to speak, rather than resist it. And yeah, there are going to be times when you really do think that maybe you're going crazy, the world's going crazy, but that's a better point of view than to just assume everything's going to be working out just mm-hmm. fine, according to some master plan that you haven't given enough thought to see whether it really, you know, ultimately makes sense at all, you know. But it's within a comfort zone. I think it's really, you know, I think it's hard to get out of our comfort zone. It's hard to mm-hmm. to challenge ourselves and think like, oh, maybe, you know, maybe I do need to take a moment to research this or not just, you know, accept it because it just makes my day more simple and easier. You know, like we're saying about politics, I mean, my God, I feel like if someone had really strong moral fiber, they'd probably get squeezed out of the system early on. If you don't play along with the game of corruption, they'll find a way, you know, to squeeze you out, whether fabricate something about you or just, you know, not let you play in the games they play because you don't go along with the, you know, with the existing system where people are just seems to be inherently corrupt.
Yeah, I mean, I'm into the seventh and I think final season of Billions Paul Giamatti and Damian Lewis. And as it, you know, you expect the billionaires to be wolves. You expect them to be predatory. So it's not nice, but that's the expectation. Then seeing the Chuck Rhodes character, brilliantly played by Paul Giamatti, as, you know, Paul Giamatti's always brilliant, no exceptions to that. But that you're looking at somebody who's convinced himself that it's okay to be criminal within the system to catch the criminals. And so it just and it's that kind of, okay, let's change this one thing. Let's look at corruption. Let's say that's the problem in our world, that if we could overcome corruption in our justice system, if we could overcome corruption in our penal system, in our law enforcement,
right,
then there might be peace on earth. But you know, up to this point, and I live in one of the less corrupt countries in the world. The Metropolitan Police, the largest of our 40 or so police forces, every 10 years have to dump about 10% of their officers because it's found that they're raping people, or, you know, there's a policeman convicted in this country every 5 days of a serious criminal offence. And that's because of the tribalism of being in blue and protecting those around you. And of course, you know, got to say it, that these people are doing one of the most important jobs, necessary jobs in the world. They are doing amazing and wonderful things. They should not be the focus of hatred. But where they break the law, the penalty should be more extreme. They, you know, and where they cover up one of their friends breaking the law, they should be out and gone. So dealing with corruption within the justice system, I think, is the first place. And having laws for politicians. So, for example, if a politician lies on the floor of the House, Senate, whatever, they should be stripped of office immediately. So, you know, it's controversial, but when Margaret Thatcher stood up and said that the Argentinian ship had entered the restriction zone, and it hadn't, right, and it ended in what, a loss of 800 lives, she should never have been allowed in Parliament again.
Yeah,
she knew she was lying because she'd given the order to sink it, and she knew exactly where it was, the Belgrano. But it's not a particular political party. I think if truthfulness was, and they can lie when they're not on the floor of the House, perhaps, but any politician that lies on the floor of the House knowingly seeks to deceive, they shouldn't be permitted back in. And changing that culture, which of course is exactly what Arachelov in The Courageous Follower is seeking to do, to say we have to take responsibility for our leaders. We don't just groupthink our way, and, you know, we should just follow them.
I agree. And I think in addition to that, putting something into the educational system where we're just made aware of these tendencies that we have, you know, within our societies and just our human psyche, that, you know, that we want to take, like you just said, like we talked about earlier, you know, the primary intake of information, we want to believe that to be truthful, and we resist, you know, taking in additional information, which may demonstrate that first impression isn't as accurate as we thought it was. Like, we need to have those things, you know, taught to us at a younger age, you know, so that we have some tools to fend off these kind of tendencies that we all kind of are battling against, that very often we're just completely unconscious about.
And if and when I have the chance, I mean, I've written a course for 11-year-olds about fake news, propaganda, and advertising.
Great.
And it's part of a set of what would be 12 lessons, which will, you know, the intention is to get into all of the fundamental elements of manipulation, which I talk about in the book Opening Our Minds, and put them over in a way that's child friendly. So that, with that thought, that if just one child in 100 got the idea, the world would change, because we are such innocents. We are not taught about how we're going to be conned, partly because some of the people running the system are running the con as well, that they aren't people of integrity. So, but I must say, I'm very hopeful. I think that going forward, we can make a better society. But part of that is for every individual to say, I must develop myself as an individual, my own eccentricity, my own difference, my own tastes, my own prejudices, my own preferences. I must look to these things, and I must be open to information and to change, and realize that every one of us, what we think and what we do, is important. You know, that I think there's so much of this tendency towards, you know, the soul and the spirit and the ego and the afterlife and the heaven and reincarnation and all of this stuff, rather than the collective. I'm part of humanity. Everything I do is relevant to humanity. I am a thread in the tapestry, which is humanity, and I would like to be a golden thread. I would like to have, you know, but because we're so focused on our immortality, which is to me now a bizarre concept. I can't. What would that be? You know,
I mean, every story I've ever heard, whether it's a movie or a book, whatever, where people are pursuing immortality, bad things happen. Like it's not a good idea, you know. And again, I'd say it's driven by a huge degree of narcissism and egotism of thinking that like there's, again, it's this idea that you're going to arrive to a place where you have it all figured out and you're going to be able to go on cruise control. Why would someone want immortality if you looked at it from the point of view that we just said that you're going to have to swim forever for the rest of your life? Do you really just want to swim, or do you think you're going to just be able to sit on the rats and coats? No, life is clearly demonstrated. You just have to swim the whole time. You're not going to get to the place where you just get to the beautiful island and you're surrounded by the great weather. And that's just not the thing. So yeah, I think all of that is not a good idea. And it only demonstrates a lack of awareness that this is just a school, a temporary school to teach. And to, the more that we can embrace the fact that the fact that things aren't the way that we wish they were is part of the teaching, that the fact that we wish they could be different. And even if they're battles we know we can't directly impact, it helps us create some sort of moral compass to try to get ourselves through life. Like, I wish, I don't agree with the way this is happening. I don't like, when I find out that this is going that way. But I also know, with humility, that it's not a fight that I can impact. So I can't let it ruin my day, but it helps me form a point of view to hopefully guide myself in a moral compass in a way to kind of make my way through life. So like you just said, that I have an individual point of view. I know how I feel about myself and the world, and I am, implicit to knowing it's individual, and that's okay, and that should be something that should be nurtured and encouraged.
Yeah, absolutely. And possibly on that point, we should conclude.
I think so. Well, that was fun. Yeah, I think this is these type of conversations and reminding people that we just, the more we learn about who we are and how we're wired, the better off we are to interpret the things around us in a more accurate way, because it's tough out there. It's hard, don't realize you've got these unconscious things happening. A lot of times the world doesn't make sense when there is an opportunity to kind of see it maybe a little bit more, clearly.
Yeah, and make some contribution to it be part of it. I think so much of the mental illness, the upset and the distress in our culture is people not feeling that they're contributing anything.
Yeah.
We are fortunate because we had these awful experiences, we are able to help people not have these awful experiences. So it gives worth to our lives.
Well, like you said, you can't give up hope, right? You can't give up hope. Yeah.
No, and I don't. And I must say at age 68 that I feel a lot more optimistic. In fact, I don't think I've ever really felt optimistic, but now I think, it's all right. It's a great thing to be alive. I was thinking about writing a little note for my kids, when I die, for them to see. And it was like, oh, at last it's over. Thank God.
Well, I did this with my mother. We did a couple great interviews with her before she left. So we had things on video, and I think those things are valuable too. Thing that becomes kind of archival. I think those are wonderful things. So letters, all those sort of things. She actually took the time to write each of her grandchildren a letter, and I thought that was really beautiful too. So I think. Yeah, we're getting up there in years, John, so we have to think about these things,
Yeah, I do think that I feel sorry for my kids, because there are now nearly 500 videos on this channel, and I've published more than 500 articles and 9 books and all the stuff I haven't published, and some poor sod is going to have to, cart it out and burn it or something. But with my own father and mother, all I've got of my father is the Answerphone tape that he left. That's all. It's the only place we have his voice recorded.
Wow.
And I have my mum commenting on a couple of where I was making videos of my kids, that
Yeah.
she sat in her chair and we have her voice. But it is a wonderful thing. Anyway,
Okay.
this has been a great treat and a pleasure as always, Hoyt. And I'll
To
see you in a
see.
month or so.
Sounds great. Cheers, mate.
Grant.
Hi, John here. Thanks for watching. We'd appreciate it very much if you would click like, as well as subscribe, and click the bell for notifications. Every dollar helps, and we welcome new patrons on Patreon, or you can make a one-off payment with any currency through PayPal. Thanks so much.